We are now streaming live. Ms. Tiza, you may begin court.
Thank you. United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks so much for being on the Zoom this afternoon. Before we get going, I'll just give you a few kind of rules of the road. Please know, first and foremost, that we've read your materials. So we've read the briefs and the cases that you've cited, the record materials. And so in the limited time you have before us, don't waste that time with factual and procedural ramp up. This is a complex case. There's a lot going on. So I would say just go ahead and get right to the core of the issues that you think drives a decision in your favor. And second, a little bit different here on Zoom, but you'll see the clock on your screen that will count down. Green is go, yellow is slow, and red, we would just ask that you conclude. Once you see the light go red, please conclude your remarks. If we carry you beyond your allotted time, don't worry about that. That's on us, not you. But I would ask that you respect the court's time. It's particularly difficult on Zoom for us to stop you. And so I will just ask that you try to stop yourselves. All right. With that, we will call the case, which is United States versus Crespo 24-10310. Got Mr. Make sure I'm pronouncing this right. Reisenstein.
Yes, sir.
Bingo. Mr. Reisenstein here for the appellant. Mr. Clark here for the appellee. Mr. Reisenstein, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can fire away whenever you're ready.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. My name is Philip Reisenstein. I represent the appellant, Alperico Crespo, in this matter. Justice is best served when cases or issues are decided on the merits and form should not best substance. And with the constitutional issue regarding the Title III search of the phones, the wiretaps, and the motion to suppress, that was not heard by the district court. That's exactly what happened here. Now, make no mistake, there's no argument here that the motion was not filed in accordance with either Rule 12 or the timeline specifically sent by the local Rule 88.9, which is 28 days after arraignment. That's clear. There were, I believe, a half a dozen or more motions to continue. And while one of them referenced a scheduling order in the motion to continue, were the government's argument to be it wasn't specifically continued, the scheduling order for the motions, I think the record fairly supports that. So what we're down to is really this important point. The judge denied the motion without hearing it, called it untimely. It is, in fact, abuse of discretion. It was arbitrary. It was based both on an erroneous view of the law and not supported by the record. An immediate motion for reconsideration was filed. It was summarily denied. The time frame, I think, is crucial for this court's understanding and adjudication of this point. And let me pause for a moment and say, how important is this point? Well, in reading the government's well-written brief, their response to pretty much every issue raised is at some point a citation to the evidence obtained during the Title III. So this issue permeates the entire trial in this matter. So I think there's two things for this court to consider. Was there good cause for not filing the motion timely? And then secondly, what were the merits of the motion? Let me—
Mr. Reisenstein, let me ask you just one question, because it strikes me that there's like untimeliness and then there's untimeliness. And this was not sort of like a barely passed the deadline. This was, you know, it seems to me like you waited 3 months from the critical, you know, sort of time to file anything, and just relatively shortly before trial. So what do you say about that?
I respectfully disagree a little bit with your question, and I will answer both parts to it. First of all, there was a large delay. I think the time expired sometime in February of 2021, and we have a motion that's filed in October of 2022. But let me draw your attention to the crucial point. a large part of certainly almost the entire affidavit for the first wiretap was based on an individual named a CS2. CS2 was a government informant for which there is an entire host of problems. His file, the documents were turned over to the defense in July 2022. So the delay in filing the motion to suppress when you're thinking about good cause is when the government provides this discovery in July and the motion is filed in October.
Well, I guess that's the 3 months I'm wondering about. Okay. What accounts for the 3 month delay between July and October?
Well, I can't account for the hard work of the defense attorneys. This is a voluminous case. There was a lot of issues here. I can't tell you that. I don't know precisely how much was in the government's discovery dump. But I do know that what was turned over, and I'm not ascribing any sort of nefarious conduct, but this CS report that was turned over in 2022 was available to the government before the start of the case, because it's dated July 25th, 2018. So respectfully, that shows that the judge erred here. When the judge had ruled that there was discovery that was provided pre-indictment and timely, there was not this kind of discovery. And Judge Newsom, let me just jump to one more important point. When you look at the timeline, after the judge denies the motion for reconsideration in October of 2022, October 14th, there's an unopposed motion to continue October 31st. The motion was granted until April 10th of 2023, 6 months later. So we had time here to adjudicate this motion. And quite frankly, I think it's form over substance in this regard, because we've shown good cause. We've shown that the government did not provide the crucial information attacking the wiretaps during the first or second wave of discovery. And that's the reality of the way we practice law. I'm not ascribing anything bad to the government. There's a ton of discovery, sometimes millions of documents. It comes in waves. And I would say that these lawyers, because it was multiple ones, pretty much did all that they could to discern what was important, find it, write a motion to suppress, and get it out. Yes, there was a delay of 3 months from July to October.
So let me ask one more question, and then I'll zip it. What about the fact the government points out in its brief that a number of the alleged misrepresentations or omissions that you point to don't really have anything to do with the incident report?
Well, not all of them do. That's correct. But when we're talking about the crucial first one, let me explain that a lot of this hinged on the credibility of CS2. He was identified as somebody who was a good Samaritan in the affidavit, only to learn that he was asking for money in this report that they received in July, and that he was asking for help in his immigration status, that he had in fact been disavowed by a law enforcement agency prior to this, and I don't believe that that was fully disclosed. So there was a lot there that should have come out in a Franks hearing and been adjudicated. Moving further then, I think then that because there's a lot to have come out at a Franks hearing, you know, what we have to rely on in response to your question is the government saying, no harm, no foul. Us saying pretty big harm, pretty big foul, should have been a Franks hearing. And in something of this kind of import, where the case is then delayed for another 6 months, I think it was a abuse of discretion. I think we've met the standard for that.
Now, let me ask you this, I guess. But to get the Franks hearing, don't you have to make some sort of materiality showing, namely that, you know, that probable cause would have been lacking? And have you really made that showing or even an effort to make that showing in the briefing?
I believe we have. I would alert the court. I don't have the page in front of me. That, again, this crucial first affidavit cites to the fact that the government is telling the magistrate that there is an investigation into Dr. Gonzalez DTO, drug trafficking organization, and it is based around Gonzalez and Diaz. What they don't tell the court is Gonzalez had been indicted. That investigation was closed. There was, in fact, no reason for this. And Gonzalez was indicted without the use of wiretaps. Additionally, just lost my train of thought, but additionally, with regard to that, the information that was sought in the subsequent wiretaps did not mention any evidence obtained from the earlier wiretaps. They changed sort of horses midstream and mentioned an entirely different conversation. And finally, I would say this, as I know I'm running out of time, the judge didn't base his ruling on that. The judge said untimely. So I wish I was here arguing to you with a record of a legal analysis of a Franks hearing. I think we'd all feel more comfortable for that. The Constitution would be served, and that's what the law should do. It should promote adjudication on the merits.
Now, you've got a minute and 20 seconds. You're certainly happy to stop now if you want to, and we can tack it onto your rebuttal. But you should be aware that things that you don't touch here, you probably can't argue for the first time in your rebuttal.
I do understand that, and I know I'm going up against a very experienced counsel, but I'm going to do my best quickly within this minute and say this. The second, I think, very important point that also touches a constitutional basis here is the failure to give the good faith jury instruction. Now, I would point out that the government's incorrect in their brief when they cite to U.S. versus Petrie, where they say there's an evidence predicate for good faith. There's not. Petrie was an advice of counsel defense. And the good faith, again, sort of unravels the Gordian knot here. It explains everything that this law enforcement officer was doing, talking to somebody like Diaz, somebody who is a Santeria priest. I don't mean his religion. He apparently corresponds with the dead. But more importantly, he's clearly somebody dealing in drugs. You've got a federal agent dealing with him. The law is that if there's any decent evidence for a defense, an instruction should be given. It was not done. I'm going to stop now and turn over to Mr. Clark unless there's more questions for me.
All right, very well. I appreciate the discipline and the self-policing on the clock. Thank you very much. Mr. Clark, fire away.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christopher Clark. I represent the United States in this matter today. I was also co-trial counsel before the district court. Addressing the primary issue raised by Mr. Reisenstein, that has to do with the court's denial of the motion to suppress as being untimely. And there are some peculiarities in this case that provide the necessary context to understand exactly what figured into the judge's decision. The first peculiarity in this case was the fact that this takedown took place during COVID. Appellant Alberico Crespo, an agent, had been arrested in July of 2020 in the midst of COVID. Our grand juries were not functioning until January of 2021. So it was necessary to file a complaint and then just preserve the grand jury in order to return formal charges once they resume meeting. Despite the fact that there was no indictment, the government sought a protective order from the magistrate permitting it to provide discovery to defense counsel. A Jose Quinone, a very experienced, prominent criminal defense attorney here in Miami, represented Crespo from its inception, the case's inception. And the government in September of 2020 provided all the wiretap materials, the applications, the orders, the tape recordings, the line sheets, voluminous information pertaining to the wiretap. And Mr. Quinone had that in his possession through the formal indictment on January 10th of 2021. The defendant was arraigned on January 14th, 2021. Before the U.S. magistrate at his initial appearance, he was advised that Local Rule 88.9 governs that all criminal pretrial motions must be filed within 28 days of arraignment. And Mr. Quinone did not see fit to challenge the government's wiretap. Some 1.5 years passed from the date of arraignment until another second peculiarity occurred in this case, that being the temporary appearance of another criminal defense attorney by the name of Sam Rabin. Mr. Rabin filed his notice of appearance and filed the motion to suppress a wiretap on the very same day in October of 2022. And the government responded saying that this motion was untimely pursuant to local rules. Moreover, Mr. Rabin never consulted with the government to ascertain his position. And the government also set forth that the defense had been in possession of these materials having to do with the wiretap for a considerable amount of time, some 2 years from when they were first produced to the defense. If one examines the motion to suppress, there were three grounds alleged by the temporary counsel. One, the government failed to exhaust other investigative means at short of getting a wiretap. Two, that the applications lacked sufficient probable cause. And three, for the Franks motion. And within that Franks motion, the defense, the temporary counsel, cited 12 bullet points as far as alleged misrepresentations. Only two of those concerned CS2, Ruben Sadalago, who appears in respect to another issue raised by the appellant in this case. One had to do with the fact that he believed that Diaz, the main cooperating witness on behalf of the government, who was a target of the wiretap, whose phone was tapped, may or may not have been bragging about whether or not Crespo was on the take. And that came from the incident summary report. And the other allegation involving the informant was, although he is primarily motivated as a good citizen to cooperate, he had hoped to gain some sort of consideration with his immigration hearing and perhaps being paid. That was not culled from the FBI incident report that was provided in July of 2022. And so only one of the 12 tenets contained within the Franks hearing had anything to do with this FBI incident summary. And the FBI incident summary, Your Honor, is merely a cursory report which describes the fact that this person, CS2, Ruben Sadalango, was no longer being utilized as an informant, not because he was unworthy of belief, not because he engaged in any misconduct, because he was not considered effective and not willing to develop additional leads pursuant to the request of law enforcement. So when the court was provided with this by an attorney who is not even permanent counsel, the government or the court was well within its rights to deny the motion on the basis of the fact that it was untimely. Now, interesting enough, Judge, that was Your Honor, the only appearance whatsoever by Mr. Rabin, the temporary counsel, had to do with the filing of this motion. He had no further participation in this case whatsoever. He was not part of the trial team on behalf of the defendant. And when the time came for trial, a year hence, during the course of trial, the government admitted the wiretap materials, the tape recordings, and so forth, without any objection by Mr. Canone, the counsel on behalf of the appellant.
Well, I guess I thought, this is just sort of hearkening back to my days as a civil litigator, where I was like the appellate geek on the trial team, trying to make sure the trial team, you know, sort of preserved objections. And so we went round and round about these, you know, motions in limine. And if you get a definitive ruling on the record under 103, I thought you were safe to tell your trial lawyer, hey, don't worry, we bookmarked this for appeal. You don't have to make a nuisance of yourself, a pest of yourself to keep objecting. So, I mean, that the failure to object during trial, is that fatal given the fact that it seems to me the defense had gotten a definitive ruling ahead of trial?
What was indicative and telling about Mr. Canone's remarks when the issue came up about the admission of the wiretap materials is he was not challenging the legality of the wiretap. It was not his choice to file a motion to suppress, obviously, by his failure to have done so in the 2 years pendency of this case. It was only when Mr. Rabin, the temporary counsel, came in and filed the motion that this issue was ever raised. So this was not the intent of the lead trial counsel representing Crespo to challenge the wiretap whatsoever. And he told the court, I am not charging the legality of the wiretap. So the court was never called upon to make a ruling one way or another as to the legality of it, notwithstanding the pretrial ruling barring the motion to suppress because it was untimely.
So just so I'm understanding, I don't think I quite understand. Are you saying that, like, because the guy who got the definitive ruling on the motion, the pretrial motion, wasn't the lead trial counsel, and the lead trial counsel seems maybe to have had his own ideas about challenging this, that Crespo himself doesn't get the benefit of that definitive ruling? I don't think I quite understand that.
I don't know exactly the status of a temporary counsel, Your Honor, who was never formally admitted to appear on behalf of the defense to begin with. And that's why I say this is a very peculiar situation. And
Director Clark, are you saying that Mr. Rabin, he filed a notice of appearance, or did you just file a random motion?
He filed a temporary notice of appearance.
Okay.
And typically one would wait to be admitted as counsel of record, I would think, before forging ahead and filing a motion, but he did not do so. The court never recognized him as permanent counsel. The court may have had some issues with that.
You don't have to be permanent counsel. I mean, there's multiple defendants who have, you know, one or two or even three defense attorneys representing them. I mean, you could have a lead attorney, but you can have also other attorneys filing motions on your behalf. Is that not correct?
I think the record reflects that Mr. Quinone wasn't even aware of the filing of this motion, that this was all done sideways to his participation as the lead attorney in this case. The motion was filed, the court considered
it. Mr. Rabin is a very well-known, regarded criminal defense attorney, just like Mr. Quinone. It's not like he's some random criminal defense attorney.
I think it'd be more compelling, Judge, if he had joined the case and continued participating in defense of Mr. Crespo other than just banning the case. But be that as it may, when the court was presented with this issue about admitting the tapes, when it arose, the defense attorney affirmatively said, we are not pursuing the legality of the wiretaps. So I believe they're waiving any issue, they're inviting any error, and therefore they haven't preserved the error, and it would have to be plain error in this case.
But just so I'm clear, you're not dying in that ditch. I mean, my understanding is that you're saying, look, we think the issue is abandoned, but even if it's not abandoned, then on the merits of the good cause issue, we win anyway.
Yes, Judge. And I think the motion for reconsideration that raised the fact that this FBI incident summary was provided, and that's what triggered the filing of the motion, is specious, because as I pointed out, that there was only one of 12 allegations concerning Franks that was ever addressed by that incident summary. So the original counsel, Mr. Quinone, had all the adequate grounds to file a motion. If they had chosen in the two preceding years, chose not to, the court was well within its discretion that within 2 months of trial, it was not going to consider this motion, that it was at least 18 months tardy. If there are no further questions having to do with the motion to suppress issue, I'll just briefly address the good faith jury instruction. In this case, good faith was not warranted. The district court was correct in saying that there is no evidence in the record to support a good faith instruction. The defendant did not take the stand and assert that he believed that it was appropriate and proper for him to conceal an investigation involving his good friend who was involved in oxycodone dealing. The court relied upon the general intent instructions and the specific offense instructions, which accurately conveyed the mens rea required for the respective offenses. And the appellant in this case has not been able to point out that there is anything lacking about those jury instructions. And I don't believe that Crespo was denied a fair trial by virtue of the fact that good faith instruction was not provided. The defense in this case, as expressed in the opening statement, was he was unaware of the drug dealing that occurred with respect to Jorge Diaz. And that would not be conducive or consistent with providing a good faith jury instruction in this case.
Can I ask you to address briefly, and then Mr. Reisenstein can address it if he wants to on rebuttal, the Confrontation Clause issue about the recross of Slattery. So our precedent says that recross is required when a new matter is broached on redirect. What does that mean to the government? What constitutes a new matter?
Evidence that was being introduced in for the first time on redirect examination or on cross-examination, Judge, raising new issues, but merely clarifying what had previously been brought out on cross is not a new issue. I think the brief addresses the fact that these were not new issues. and that the appellant or the defendant in this case was not entitled to recross examination, and that the appellant has not established in the record whatsoever what questions, if any, they would have asked that would have changed the outcome of this trial.
So is it just that the evidence itself has to be new, or questioning about the evidence has to be new? Because it seems like here we might not have the latter, but we might not have the former, but we do have the latter.
Questions outside the scope of direct that were first brought out in cross-examination, I would think would be fair game if the court in its discretion wants to allow for recross-examination. But that wasn't the case here, that these were all issues that had been brought out on direct, established on cross, and clarified on redirect by the government.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I will conclude my remarks. Thank you all for your consideration.
Very well. Mr. Reisenstein, you've got 5 minutes of rebuttal time remaining.
Thank you. Judge Newsom, let me address one question that you asked my colleague, Mr. Clark. In my reply brief, I cite to the court the case of United States versus Davis that to preserve a right, a party need not continually reassert it after a court has ruled. And all of you, including Mr. Clark, are correct. We had exceptionally experienced defense attorneys here. There was no waiver by Mr. Quinone, as good a trial lawyer as there is. There was his normal, honest, frank answer to a question, as normally is asked by every district court judge when evidence is submitted regarding, is there objection to it? And he said, I can't object. I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm close to it. And it comes from Mr. Clark's brief. I can't object. I didn't file a motion to dismiss. I think in the heat of battle, it might have been better to say there was a motion to suppress, rather. And I think in the heat of battle, probably would have been better to say there was a motion to suppress filed. It was never ruled on. It was untimely. But one can't look at the mountain of evidence. And as I said, one only need read Mr. Clark's excellent brief, government's excellent brief, to see just how important the Title III evidence was. Now, let me address Mr. Clark's point that what happened with CS2 was, you know, just a small part of this. CS2 was the major contributor to the first application. And I feel comfortable in saying no CS2, maybe we're not here, no Title III application. Here's what I've identified from the motion to suppress document 182, paragraph 21, on or about March 2019, CS2 voluntarily contacted the FBI regarding concerns about Mr. Crespo. Notably, the affidavit does not state that in 2018, when he initially reported the information, he stated he did not think Mr. Crespo was corrupt. Furthermore, the affidavit does not state that in 2018, he was determined to be unreliable. And let me stop right there. I know all of you in your career, mine in criminal law, and Mr. Clark's as well, has seen affidavits based on knowledge an agent has and reliability of an informant. And if they can't say that, they're not approaching probable cause. So it's not the quantity of times, it's the quality of this. And the quality of it, as the motion to suppress makes clear, is that CS2 was integral to the affidavit. I've already pointed out that it wasn't brought out that he wanted help with his citizenship and to be paid. And finally, the affidavit, again, quoting from paragraph 32, the affidavit omitted the fact that CS2 explicitly stated he's not sure whether Diaz is bragging or telling the truth. And that is in relation to some statements that are coming from Diaz that he's got protection from a law enforcement agent. Now, with regard to good faith, let me say that knowledge and intent, which is the cornerstone of much of the witness tampering and the obstruction of justice counts, can't be defended because he knowingly spoke to Mr. Diaz and he intentionally spoke to Mr. Diaz. what he wanted to be able to argue to the jury, and there's no rule he had to testify. It came out through their defense witnesses, opening statement, theory of the case, is that he had a good faith reason, and this delves into his religion of Santeria, and Mr. Diaz occupied a high portion of that religion, so it was someone that he had to grant respect to. And littered throughout these very long, complex briefs are phone calls about what Agent Crespo is saying about Mr. Diaz, how he knows him. The government is saying, look, that's proof of his corruptness. And the defense is saying, no, he's admitting that he knows him. He's saying he doesn't think he's a bad guy. And underneath all of this is the good faith that he's talking to somebody that in his belief, and I'm not here to criticize it, is a spiritual advisor to that matter. I believe very briefly for recross, Mr. Quinon argued, as is in the record, that new information came out for which he felt he was hamstrung and could not address. Thank you for your time.
Okay, very well. The case is submitted and the court will be in adjournment. Thank you.